You're tuned to The Weekend, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon. I'm Louis Sines, your host for The Weekend. And joining us today on the first half of the program is Dr. Griffin Rogers. Dr. Rogers is the director of the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases. And we're going to talk about, well, something that we all tend to have a little bit of a problem with, and that's gaining a little bit of weight between Thanksgiving and New Year's Day. And before I go ahead and talk a little bit more, I want to welcome you, Dr. Rogers. Thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Well, thanks for having me on your show.
So tell us a little bit about the Institute, sir.
Sure. Well, the NIH's National Institute of Diabetes, Digestive, and Kidney Diseases is one of 27 institutes and centers that exist in Bethesda, Maryland, just as a suburb just north of Washington. NIDDK, as we abbreviate it, is responsible for some of the most common and chronic and costly and consequential disorders affecting Americans today, including diabetes and related endocrine diseases. It's responsible for digestive diseases and nutrition. Digestive diseases being things like esophagitis, reflux esophagitis, ulcers, irritable bowel syndrome, inflammatory bowel disease, various liver diseases. And then we're also responsible for kidney, urologic, and hematologic diseases, both acute kidney injury, chronic kidney failure, leading to dialysis, as well as some benign urology conditions, including, for example, kidney stones. So you can see we really cover a wide range of topics. Conditions like obesity, for example, we're the principal institute responsible for, which sort of leads into our discussion about weight gain during the holiday season. And we think that this is really a great time to start talking about small steps towards a healthier New Year's.
And so what do people need to do, Dr. Rogers? As you are very well aware of, people get invited to parties, get-togethers with their family, it depends also on your culture. Here on the border, a lot of Hispanic families, it's almost like a love language. Mom gives you this, you have to try grandma's this, and if not, it's almost like sometimes they get insulted. But, of course, that's not like they're, holding a gun to their head. Everybody makes individual choices.
The point in Texas, for example, 32% of adults in Texas considered obese, and 36% are overweight. And it's not limited just to adults. 16% of adolescents are either obese or overweight. So the number is great. And during the holiday season, despite what you hear in the media, most people only gain about a pound or even less between Thanksgiving and New Year's. But if you're already starting off obese or overweight, you add that pound, you don't lose it. Over time, you begin to increase that number, and of course you then put yourself at risk for a number of serious health problems like diabetes and high blood pressure and kidney disease and heart disease and the like. So the simple three things that we suggest moving forward is portion size, limiting the amount of food that you eat and limiting the amount of sugar and fat and salt that's in the food that you eat. Also, a lot of people spend time being inactive in front of video games or in front of computers or in front of the 200 or 300 channels that we have on our TVs now. And so limiting your screen time. And then third, especially over the holidays, lack of sleep has been shown to increase one's risk of weight gain. So don't sacrifice sleep to try to get in more during the busy holiday season.
People may not realize, unless they are afflicted themselves, how serious diabetes can be. And people who suffer from either hyper or hypoglycemic, it's very difficult. I'm diabetic myself, and I know sometimes my glucose levels will drop, and I feel horrible.
Yeah, and unfortunately, increasingly, we're seeing so many more people. In the country, at the present time, there are roughly 29 million Americans who have diabetes, and there's another 86 million who have what's called prediabetes. That is, that their blood sugar numbers are not quite high enough yet to characterize them of having diabetes, but it's certainly higher than normal. And sometimes within the next 5 years or so, they're at a very high risk of moving over to the diabetes category. Having episodes of hyperglycemia when the blood sugar is too high, or as a result of taking your medications, dropping your blood sugar too low, really can make you feel miserable. And so we're trying our best with research to not only develop better therapies to maintain that blood sugar in a more of a normal range to prevent those swings, but also in people who have pre-diabetes to try to prevent them or delay them from ever becoming diabetic. That's really the major effort of the research in our institute.
We're visiting with Dr. Griffin Rogers. Dr. Rogers is the director of the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, also commonly known as NIDDK. Dr. Rogers, what about the children who have type 1 diabetes?
Yeah. Well, the kids with type 1 diabetes, it is a difficult struggle because, of course, with the kids, the families are also involved. And diabetes, or especially type 1 diabetes, which I would distinguish for your listeners from type 2. Type 2 is generally a disease that your body is actually making enough insulin, but it's just not effective in terms of bringing the sugar in from the bloodstream into the important tissues. Type 1 diabetes, or what we used to call juvenile diabetes, is a condition in which the body's immune system begins to attack the insulin-producing cells in the pancreas, and as a direct consequence of that, these individuals require insulin to live. And there is where one can get these wide swings in the blood sugar from hypoglycemia, very low levels, to hyperglycemia. And some recent advances in terms of developing an artificial pancreas, which actually both measures the blood sugar instantaneously, sends that information through a computer that then adjusts the flow of insulin to really simulate or replace the effects of the pancreas is what's occurring in those situations. Of course, again, since this is in children, parents usually are very leery of sleeping. They oftentimes get up in the night to check the kids' blood sugar just to make sure they don't have these dangerous low levels. And so we're really about research efforts to stop this disease progression in its earliest stage, but also to develop better ways to allow kids and adults now with the condition to live healthier and longer lives, and lives that are not as disruptive as having to check your blood sugar multiple times a day and giving yourself multiple injections of insulin.
And Dr. Rogers, because type 1 diabetes usually affects the children, this has to be especially difficult during the holidays.
Absolutely. And it's all the more reason that one has to be very careful in terms of what one eats. And so, again, and this is information that's not only important for type 1 diabetics, but also people with type 2 diabetes, you know, making sure that you avoid the sweets, eating moderate, being moderate in terms of your portion size. And, you know, one good tip is don't save up your appetite for a big meal. You know you're going to a party, you know you're going to family or friend's house, or likely to go to a restaurant. It might be a good idea to grab an apple or some veggies or something to eat beforehand. That way you'll be less tempted to go overboard once you get to those friends or family's houses or a party, or if you go out to a restaurant. If you're at a restaurant, for example, share a meal with someone, or take half of it home with you, and then you can enjoy it the next day. Or you could also order an appetizer as a main meal. So these are ways to sort of think about portion size, which really is an important feature to minimizing and eating healthier and staying on track during the new year.
We are visiting with Dr. Griffin Rogers. Dr. Rogers is the director of the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, NIDDK. Dr. Rogers, what about As you are very well aware of, social media is out there, and there are so many YouTube videos, so much information that we are warned by doctors and other people to not research or Google stuff, because then all of a sudden it'll make us like, oh my gosh, I'm going to die, or this is going to happen. So what would you advise for people? You want them to be informed, but at the same time, you don't want them to just be looking or reading the wrong information.
Absolutely. And you also don't want them to sort of go down a path of using either therapies or you know, some diet that really is not only not going to be effective, but it's preventing you from actually getting the appropriate advice. So, you know, I recommend to your listeners to look at, you know, more credible websites, and there are a number of these. I'll get to my own in a minute, but there are many of these that one can look at and follow the, and not just one, but look at several, because as you see, several of these websites giving the same type of advice in terms of diet, in terms of exercise, in terms of amount of sleep that you get, they tend to be internally consistent, and that's really the way to move forward. These websites generally provide information based upon the latest and the most agreed upon medical research, which is really the way that we make progress moving forward. For your listeners, and since I'm on your show, let me tell you about our website. That's niddk.nih.gov. And on this site, your listeners can get a lot of information on weight management, physical activity, and other health-related topics. In fact, while they're on the site, I would encourage them to search for our body weight planner, which is an effort that we did in conjunction with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The planner helps adults set and achieve personal weight loss and physical activity goals. And because we partner with the Agriculture Department, after one defines what one's best calorie intake is, the Agriculture Department has a variety of very good a variety of various dinner plans, meal plans, and others to sort of mix it up so that one can achieve that calories that would be ideal for you. So this is really a great site, and I encourage your listeners to check in on it.
Is diabetes reversible?
To some extent, it can be, but that's obviously a long-term goal of ours. We know that people aren't born diabetic for type 2 diabetes, the one that's associated with obesity. One goes from a period of normal metabolism to a pre-diabetic stage to a stage of diabetes, and then the longer you have it, the greater your risk of developing the complications that we talked about. And all along the line, we're trying to develop ways to prevent people going to that next stage. And in fact, if they're at that next stage, research is ongoing to try to reverse that track. So we have very good information on people who are at high risk of developing diabetes, that is pre-diabetes, and the research has definitively shown that there are ways to prevent or delay the onset of diabetes. And certainly, if you have diabetes, very good information on how to prevent developing those longer-term complications. And we are focusing on people who have genes that put them at high risk of developing either prediabetes or diabetes, and what types of measures that can be done early on. And this is really the idea of what you're hearing in the press now, something called precision medicine, where you get the right drug or the right intervention, it may not be a drug, but a right intervention to the right person at the right time. And I think over time you'll be hearing more and more about precision medicine.
Dr. Rogers, we want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with us here. As we leave, if you wouldn't mind giving us the website again.
Absolutely. Our website is niddk.nih.gov. And again, you can learn a lot of information about weight management, physical activity, diabetes, prediabetes, as well as other things that I mentioned in the introduction, digestive diseases, kidney diseases and other endocrine disorders, and certainly obesity and weight management. So I really want to thank you for giving me this opportunity to share this with your listeners.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. Merry Christmas.
Same to you. Take care.
And continuing to discuss health issues, joining us on the second half of the program is Dr. Leah Wiggum, Director of the Paso del Norte Institute for Healthy Living. Dr. Wiggum, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, tell us a little bit about, first of all, your background.
Well, I have degrees in biochemistry and nutritional science, and I focused my career on studying obesity as a complex disease.
And what we're going to talk about today is something that the Institute has come up with in, about research and obesity. And a lot of times, as we were discussing before the program started, the fact that people kind of, you know, if they see someone who is obese, they'll say, well, you know, it's just your fault. You need to know how to take better care of yourself. And we tend to do that because that's just the way we stereotype.
That's correct. People who struggle with obesity face a high level of discrimination. We know this both at a regional level and at a national level. Our institute has collected some data regionally, and we know that we're in step with some of the levels of bias and discrimination towards people who struggle with obesity at the national level as well. Obesity is a very complex disease. It's not a simple matter of calories in and calories out, which people often hear. There's many social, physiological, psychological components. There's environmental aspects. There are viruses that can cause obesity, for example. There's over 100 different causes of obesity that have been identified so far. And the world of obesity research is still relatively new. There's more being learned every day. And one of the problems that people who struggle with obesity face is not only the complexity of this disease that they're dealing with, but the fact that our society as a whole tends to think that obesity is simply a matter of choice or a matter of personal behavior, that if a person had enough motivation, they would be able to maintain a healthy weight. And we know that that's simply not true. But not only that, when people struggling with obesity exist in an environment where they face a high level of discrimination and bias, it makes it even more difficult for them to address the obesity, get the kind of health care they need, but they also fear the consequences they will face. And there's good evidence to substantiate this fear that they will be discriminated against.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because even when we watch movies sometimes and you see some of these comedies where the person who is overweight, whether it be a child or a guy, he's the one who's the, you know, butt of all the jokes.
Exactly. That's very common in our media, the way that obesity gets portrayed. That's one thing that our institute, the Institute for Healthy Living, is working on, is how can we partner with professionals in the media, for example, to learn about other ways to portray obesity in a more positive and accepting manner. Oftentimes, the people struggling with obesity know a great deal about exercise and nutrition, and oftentimes are much more fit and healthier than their lean counterparts, who may not have to give much thought and attention to what they eat and how much they exercise and whether or not they smoke and some of those other health behaviors, but they may just be predisposed to being thin. They get treated completely differently than a person who's struggling with obesity, even though their behaviors and their choices may be resulting in much poorer health than the person who's struggling with obesity.
The Department of Health, and I'm not sure if it's the Department of Health, I could be wrong, but they used to have what they called the height and weight charts. And a lot of people, if they didn't fit that, they were considered, if they were applying for a job, well, you have to be, if you're this tall, you have to weigh this much. And some people just, there is no way that they're ever going to be thin.
That's correct, and that's a good point that you bring up. The tool that we often hear referred to today is called body mass index. That's a measure of weight for height, measured in kilograms of body weight over meters in height squared. And that is a tool that gets frequently used to assess a person for obesity. And the typical scale that gets used is a BMI of 18 to 25 is considered a healthy weight. 25 to 30 is considered overweight. 30 and above is considered obese. This is a useful tool, but only for screening. At that point, a healthcare provider then needs to work with that individual one-on-one to determine, does the category that their height for weight, weight for height, put them into, is that a concern or not? Because you're right, different people have different body types. One obvious way in which this scale doesn't work is for a bodybuilder. So if a person does a lot of weightlifting, they're going to have a high level of muscle mass and their weight will be higher for their height, but yet their body composition will still be in a healthy range. So what we ultimately care about is the amount of body fat that a person has, because that's what causes the increased health risks and health problems that are associated with obesity. So obesity is not defined per se by weight. It's defined by adiposity, or how much fat a person's body has. But it's really difficult for the average person to find out how much body fat they have. You go to the doctor's office, they have a scale that can measure your weight. They don't typically have a body composition analyzer that can measure your body composition. So because of our limits in technology, we're forced to use a proxy, which is the body mass index. But anyone using the body mass index as a tool on an individual basis needs to recognize that it's not the last step, it's the first step. And then at that point, there's other measures that can be used to determine that person's health risk. But regardless of how much a person weighs or what their body composition is, it's still important for them to have a healthy diet, participate in physical activity, try to reduce the amount of sedentary behavior in their day, and generally have a well-balanced, healthy approach to their life, which can also include things like how much they choose to use alcohol, smoking cessation, if that's appropriate, mental health and social health in their life as well. So that's all part of the big rounded picture of a healthy life.
We tend to live now in a what some people don't agree with, politically correct world. And so the term obesity or obese, has that changed as far as reaction or bias towards people as opposed to, say, someone is fat or overweight?
There has been a lot of research related to what people prefer as far as terms. In the field of weight bias research, we try and focus on using the word obesity to describe a disease. We avoid using obese to describe the person because we want to distinguish the person from the disease. So you don't call a person who has cancer a cancerous person. You call them a person who has cancer. So you would refer to a person with obesity as a person with obesity, or a person who struggles with their weight, or a person who you can have a thin person who continues to struggle with their weight. If they've successfully lost weight and achieved a healthy weight, they most likely will have to work hard the rest of their life to maintain that healthy weight. So whether they have a body mass index that puts them in a category of obesity or not, they would still be considered a person who struggles with obesity. So we try and use it's referred to as people first language, a person with obesity rather than an obese person. Some of the other things that we can do, when there is media coverage related to obesity, you will often see the images in the printed story or in the televised story where you can't see the person's face. And oftentimes the person is engaging in an activity that's unhealthy. So you might see the image of a person and in the picture it's cropped in such a way that their head is not included in the picture. And all you see is their body. And maybe they're sitting in a chair and eating a food that's considered unhealthy or doing some other inactive behavior, sitting in front of the TV. Where in reality, many people who struggle with obesity are out there being physically active, shopping at the grocery store for fresh fruits and vegetables, engaging in physical activity with their family members. And so when we work with media professionals, we try and encourage them to include pictures that positively portray people with obesity rather than contribute to more of a negative portrayal of people who struggle with obesity.
I'm wondering about this bias against obesity. I kind of think I know what the answer is, but I'm not. I want to hear from you as far as how does it relate to gender issues? I think that perhaps there is more criticism towards a woman who is suffers from obesity or versus a man.
I think there are studies that have shown there's a gender difference where women in some of the studies have faced higher levels of discrimination or bias. We also know from some studies that women tend to be less likely to attribute obesity to personal behavior and more likely to attribute it to a complex array of factors. That could be those particular women who answered those questions that way have enough personal experience with the disease to understand, you know, I can try much harder than my thin friends to maintain a healthy weight, and it's just really hard for me. So I know there's other things at play. But yes, there can certainly be gender differences.
One of the charts that you brought in here, and you were talking about this before the program started, that there are over 100 reasons as to or things that people have to battle.
That's right. So the chart that I brought in is an infographic available from the Obesity Society, which is a professional society. And the Obesity Society has put together this infographic to help illustrate how complex obesity really is. And there's multiple factors that can influence how much food a person eats, how many calories they burn, and ultimately how much fat is stored within their body. So there's factors related to the images we see on TV, the way the media portrays food and physical activity. Our environment around us can have a big effect. You know, how easy it is for a person to be physically active and to obtain healthy food can play a big role in how they make their choices throughout the day. If it's much harder to get to healthy food, or if it's much more socially desirable to be exposed to the unhealthy foods, it can be really hard for a person to make those choices.
Leah, we are in the era of social media, and so I'm sure a lot of our listeners would want to know if you all have a Facebook page or a web page that they can go to find out more about what we've been discussing.
We do. We're on Facebook and we're on Twitter, and we have a website. So I would be happy to share all of those if you'd like to make them available to your listeners.
Go ahead, if you wouldn't mind sharing at least the web page.
The website is pdnihl.org. And those are the initials of our institute, Paso del Norte Institute for Healthy Living, pdnihl.org.
And Facebook, the same. They can just type in Facebook and then the name of the organization.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for being with us here today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
The Weekend is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our producer is Lauren Terrazas. You've been tuned to The Weekend. I'm Luis Sainz.